Welcome to the Central Assembly Podcast. You're about to hear another inspirational message from Dr. Jim Bradford. It's our prayer that this message is an encouragement and blessing to your life.
Let's take a look at where we've been, because in chapter 16, as he wraps things up, he's going to refer to, Paul is, to some places on his second missionary journey. And so I've got my mother of all light pointers right here. And here we go. This is Jerusalem down here. And this is Antioch up here in Syria. And it's Antioch that's sort of the center of gravity during Paul's ministry of the church. It's somewhat moved from Jerusalem, the mother church, up to Antioch. And it's out of Antioch that three times Paul is sent out from that church on his missionary journeys. And this is a picture of his second missionary journey, because that's the journey in which he starts this church in Corinth that he is being called to. But he started it by going, this would be right here, all this area right here with Jerusalem down here, Antioch up here, all of this area is present-day Turkey. And so he comes and he starts through this journey. Lystra, he picks up Timothy, who now begins to become Paul's traveling partner from Lystra. He comes up here. He tries to go over here to where Ephesus is, but the Lord doesn't really allow him to do that till later in this trip. But they kept being led up here. And this is a whole area of Galatia, this eastern Turkey area. He's going to mention Galatia in the first verse of chapter 16 of 1 Corinthians. And they go over, and from here, Troas, they experience a call over to Philippi and Thessalonica, where Paul will start churches there on this journey and later write letters to them that we have in the New Testament, Philippians and 1 and 2 Thessalonians. But this whole area is northern Greece, and it's called Macedonia. You can see the word there, Macedonia, on the map. This yellow area, or this butterscotch area, is called Macedonia. It'd be northern Greece. And so then he goes down from there, and the book of Acts tells us how he stopped in Athens. And then from Athens, he goes due west about 45 miles to Corinth. And this green area is southern Greece, which is called Achaia. So Macedonia and Achaia. And here he spends an hour and a half. He spends a year and a half. This is not my morning. He spends a year and a half here in Corinth, starting the church in Corinth. And it's now this church that he's years later, on a third trip, he writes from Ephesus, which is right here. He writes back to Corinth. But on this trip, he goes and just visits Ephesus briefly. Doesn't quite start the church there, but he visits it briefly. And then he makes his way down all the way to Jerusalem. And he visits the church in Jerusalem. He's starting to carry a lot of concern for the church in Jerusalem right here, because, as I said, some of the center of gravity of the church had moved back up to Antioch. The church in Jerusalem was largely Jewish, of course. In Antioch, it was Jew and Gentile, and Paul's ministries three times take him into this part of the world where there are dispersed Jews, but a lot of Gentiles. And Jesus' church is inclusive of Jew and Gentile, both of every person, every tribe, every tongue. This is still God's passion, that his gospel will reach to every part of the world. So when we read Paul's missionary journeys, we're inspired to keep sacrificing and giving to send people all over the world. But he is concerned about home base, Paul is now. He had spent a lot of time living and teaching as a Pharisee in Jerusalem before he came to Christ. And the church here is really suffering. There's been famine in the Roman world. There had been a lot of persecution, a lot of people leaving, even believers leaving Jerusalem, going to places like Antioch. And so the church here is suffering. And so Paul now, as he starts this last chapter of 1 Corinthians, is going to take us on a journey talking about an offering that he is collecting. This is an actual offering, just like we just took a financial offering. This is a financial offering that Paul is taking so that he can bring it down as a way of saying the Gentile world stands with you, Jewish believers, where the gospel started. And we understand God's heart for you and the suffering, where it all began, and the suffering you're experiencing now. So he's raising money to help buy food and supplies and relief for the believers in Jerusalem and their capacity to minister to other people in Jerusalem during that hard period. We're about 55, 56 AD right now, and the Jerusalem church is suffering. And so let's go, and we see, first of all, as he starts chapter 16, that Jesus does care for his people. This is where generosity starts. A lot of us are going to be generous this Christmas because we are obligated to give gifts, because people would think terrible of us if we didn't give gifts. But I want to tell you, generosity in God's eyes flows through our life, but it doesn't start with us and it doesn't start with the need. It's got around us, it's got nothing to do with obligation, but it's got everything to do with his heart for people. God really does care about his people. And so Paul in 1 Corinthians 16 verse 1 says, now about the collection for the Lord's people. Now about the collection for the Lord's people. So he's referring to this offering that he, on his third missionary journey, has been collecting and encouraging them to give. All these churches that he started, he's saying, what could we do for the people from the very first church in Jerusalem? And so I was just touched this year studying this, that he refers to them as the Lord's people. I mean, when you're the Lord's person, you have a place in his heart. I mean, he loves every person, even people who technically don't belong to the Lord, who don't know about him, who are running from him. He loves every person. But there's something special about you if you're a follower of Jesus. These are not just Christians. He doesn't just call them Christians. It was in Antioch, where Paul had been sent out, that believers in Christ were first called Christians in that city. It was a derogatory term. It was like you're like little Christ. It's like you're following that crucified man. It was a shameful term, actually. But he doesn't even use the word Christian, which Christians took on as a badge of honor. He just says, you're the Lord's people. They're the Lord's people, God's own people. He's got a heart for his own people. And so I'm writing to you about the collection there. That's where generosity starts. I want to tell you, some of us, our first core value is the church, to be hungry for God, and we're seeking after God's heart. But to have God's heart and not be generous creates an incredibly bad disconnect in our Christian lives after a while, because you're living out of sync with the very heartbeat of God. He's always concerned about his people, and he's always concerned about the peoples that don't know him yet. And you get close to God's heart, and you're going to experience a push towards generosity, because his heart is constantly towards other people. That's where it starts. If you're just, and I'm going to be trudging through the malls, and I'm going to be trying, or I'm going to be on Amazon.com, and I'm going to be tempted again this year, I have to get all these gifts. What on earth am I going to get people? But God help me, God help you reframe that and say, Lord, would you just show me your heart for that person I'm buying a gift for this year? And then would you just help me to follow your heart? And at least give me grace and lead me in this process. And then Paul says, when it comes to following God's heart for people, which pulls generosity out of us, then he tells us something very practically wise. He said, you know, we will tend to give more when we give regularly. His whole issue is, what can we give to these people in Jerusalem? And isn't this true of all of us? We tend to give more when we give regularly. Because going on in verse 1, he says, so do, now about this collection for the Lord's people, do what I told the Galatian church to do. Remember Galatia on the map way over there in eastern Turkey? Do what I told those churches to do. On the first day of every week, which is what day? Sunday. The Jews generally worshiped on the Sabbath day, which is Saturday. Started at sundown on Friday night, went to sundown on Saturday, and then from sundown Saturday night through sundown on Sunday. That was the first day of the week. And one of the evidences of the resurrection of the dead, which he spent a whole chapter just talking about in chapter 15, one of the evidences is that all of these initially just Jewish believers in Jerusalem, with the Sabbath being one of the most solemn days, they began to do their worship of Jesus on Sunday morning. Why? Because it was on the first day of the week that Jesus rose again. And it took nothing short of them being convinced that they couldn't find Jesus' body, but he showed himself to them in the resurrected form, that they moved worship to Sunday morning. I'm convinced God, the devil, still hates Sunday mornings, because that's the day he lost and Jesus got away from death. So on the first day of every week, each one of you should set aside a sum of money in keeping with your income and saving it up so that when I come, no collections are going to have to be made. And Paul was saying, first of all this scrambling, oh, Paul's coming to town, we better hurry up and take that offering. No, you know, to avoid all the chaos and confusion. And, you know, you're not going to, in one offering, receive nearly as much as just every week regularly. You're in that pattern of giving. And God's work is so much more resourced. And so as we do an offering, and notice he says it's just in keeping with your income. That means some of us give less than others of us because our incomes are different. But this is very real, and there's nothing hyped, there's nothing pressured, there's nothing manipulated, there's nothing guilted here. It's just why don't you get in that habit of every week, according to your income, contributing to the offering that can build Jesus' church. This is it. And you do it in proportion to your income. That's for us today, that's the tithe. He doesn't use the word tithe here, but the tithe is in the Old Testament. It means 10%. It goes all the way back to Abraham. And as one pastor friend of me likes to say, hearts touched by God always respond with a tenth. And that is always the baseline. Probably the Corinthians gave much more than a tenth. And that generally seemed to be the pattern. Early believers were just generous. Even if other people had need, they even sold their own property to help other people. This was the power of the community of Christ, the family of God. This is what happens when Jesus' spirit and Jesus' heart for other people begins to get a hold of you. Generosity starts to flow, you know, and he just like takes us from being clenched, fisted with everything we own to being like another of our core values, to being open-handed. He pries these fists of ours open, so we're open-handed. Why? Because we're obligated to? No. Because God will get us if we don't? No. But because we're carrying his heart for our world and carrying his heart for the Lord's people. And so we give. And the tithe is a wonderful percentage. I tell you, I know, I've heard of non-believers, non-Christians who tithe because they just believe that this is such an important principle. And Ken Blanchard, who is a Christian, but he co-wrote a book. He's a management guru, quite famous around the world. Blanchard co-authored a book recently entitled How to Make Serious Money for Both You and Your Company. So that's a rather narcissistic title, right? How to make lots of money for yourself and your company. But look at one of the principles he talked about. He said, we tithe 10% of our company's profits. And he said, last year, that came to $320,000, our tithe. But here's the twist on it. Instead of just the company giving it away, we divide the tithe of our profits among all our employees for them to give it away. He said the lowest paid employee gets to give $1,000 away. And the highest paid employee gets to give $3,500 away. So they take their $320,000, which is a tithe of their profit last year, and they distribute that tithe among all of their employees, not for them to keep it, but for them to have the joy of giving it away. They're not allowed to keep it for themselves. He said, one guy in shipping came up to me with tears in his eyes. He got the chance to give $1,000 to his church to buy something the church really needed and didn't have the money for. He became a local hero. And he said, we ended up giving to 160 different charities. You see, these are even companies that so believe in the power of a proportional giving and the spirit of generosity and what it brings to us. So Paul is first of all saying that this all starts with God caring about his people. And then we tend to give more, and we tend to give better when we give regularly. So that this is, he said, every Lord's Day, first day every week when you gather, just give in proportion to your income. I do it monthly, but I do it on recurring giving because I found when I used to not use recurring giving, I'd skip months and not realize it, and then that's less to the work of God. I don't want to live that way. I always bring a bill with me, though, to put into the offering as an act of worship. Every time I'm in service, I always try to put something there, but that's not most of my giving. I do go online and do it recurring giving, and I just find I can give more when I'm just doing it piece by piece regularly rather than just, and it's fine if you do it all at the end of the year, that's fine, but we tend to give more when we give regularly, and that's part of the process. And then, thirdly, accountability, Paul says, is a part of the process. Accountability, when it comes to caring God's heart and being generous, accountability is also a part of the process. First of all, there's accountability on the part of the receiver of the funds, those that the funds are given to. And that's why Paul says, then when I arrive, I will give letters of introduction to the men you approve, and I will send them with your gift to Jerusalem. And if it seems advisable for me to go also, I will accompany them, or they will accompany me. So obviously, if you're going to have an offering that's being collected from all kinds of churches throughout Turkey and Greece, you're not going to send it with one person, right? There's got to be some accountability by those who receive the funds to the donors. There's got to be some kind of accountability. And so, and partly for security too. They're going to take that hazardous journey all the way down Jerusalem. But his emphasis here is not on the security of that money, but it's on the accountability. And that's why he writes, he says, there'll be letters of introduction, and it'll be men taking that money who only you approve. And they're going to take that gift to Jerusalem, and if it will help to validate it all, I even will go with them to Jerusalem. So this is just chock full of accountability. And we still believe that. If we ask donors to give, the receiving organization needs to be more than accountable. That's why we have our books in our church audited every year. That's why we have voting members that we receive into membership several times a year, because it's the voting members who we account to for how money is used and spent here. There needs to be accountability by the organizations that we give money to. But then Paul says, very interestingly, there should also be accountability on behalf of the donors. Donors need to be held accountable are you really carrying out God's heart for our world? Or are you keeping everything for yourself? And this is where he's going to go next. Because there are some verses in 2 Corinthians, his next letter to them, that I'm going to read briefly, and they're going to be very familiar with you, but I want you to connect some dots. In chapter 16 here, he says, now about the collection to the Lord's people. I want you to connect it every week, just according to your income, and then be ready for when I come, and then there's going to be lots of accountability here, letters of introduction, only people you approve that will carry that offering, and we're going to take it to Jerusalem. And this may be no surprise after the previous 15 chapters of 1 Corinthians, but were they just Johnny on the spot with this? No. They dragged their feet. In fact, we don't know exactly when Paul writes 2 Corinthians, but it was at least several months later. Some scholars believe as much as 2 years later he wrote 2 Corinthians, and they still had not delivered on this offering. They were just like this, their hands clutched clenched full. We are not letting go of our money unless we absolutely have to. God's heart, nothing. We're keeping our money. And so Paul has to write them again about this same offering that he refers to in 1 Corinthians 16. And these will be familiar verses to you. 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 1. Remember, Macedonia was in northern Greece, Greek province, and there in Corinth is in the southern Greece. He says, "And now, brothers and sisters, we want you to know about the grace of God that is given the Macedonian churches. In the very midst of a very severe trial, their overflowing joy and their extreme poverty welled up in rich generosity." Now, in 1 Corinthians 16, Paul's not near as confrontive about this offering as he is about other issues. You know, he's just been in their face for 15 chapters long. Then he gets to the offering, and he's just really polite. And he said, you know, just as you can every month, every week, and then we'll make sure the right people deliver it and account for it. So he's not in their face. And he's not exactly in their face again this time, but he is kind of jabbing them a little bit. He's appealing to their spirit of competition. He's saying, now those churches up in Macedonia, you know, they have less than you have. But they've already been giving sacrificially. So, hey, what's wrong with you guys, huh? When are you going to get your act together? So he's kind of, you know, we wouldn't call this manipulation, but we would call it subtle motivation. We'd call it carnal motivation. If for nothing else, don't let them outpace you up there in northern Greece. And what an equation. Overflowing joy plus extreme poverty equals rich generosity. Who would ever put that together? Except when we walk in the generosity of God's heart, life becomes miraculous. I mean, how do you take joy and poverty and end with rich generosity? Because the joy is always outweighs the poverty, and there's something about God's supply. And they were, even though they didn't have the money, they ended up just, in fact, you'll go on to say, I tried to let them up there where there's a lot of unemployment in Macedonia, I tried to let them off the hook because they didn't have a lot. And it says, literally, they begged me to be able to give to the church in Jerusalem. They begged me to do it. And so their joy and their poverty added together to end up with generosity. And so he's kind of subtly saying to the Corinthians, so meanwhile, what are you losers been doing lately? I mean, what's your excuse? I mean, don't be so holy when you read all this stuff, right? I mean, Paul's not beyond a little sarcasm. Verse 7, but since you excel in everything, here he's going to really butter them up, right? Because the Spirit of God was very active in this church in spite of all its problems. But he says, since you excel in everything, you excel in faith and in speech and in knowledge, some of the gifts of the Spirit there, and in complete earnestness and in the love we have kindled in you, you excel in all this. See also that you excel in this grace of giving. Would you just add that to the package? So he's trying to just pad this a little bit. But he's concerned that they're not coming through on what he wrote to them about in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, about this offering. And it's months and months later, and they still haven't done anything. So he's going there. And he called it not the obligation of giving, but the grace of giving. And then two verses later, he picks up on that word grace for one of the most stunning verses in the New Testament. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus. See, generosity starts with Jesus in his heart, not our obligation or even our feeling bad about human need around us. Grace is from Jesus in his heart. For you know the grace of the Lord Jesus, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you through his poverty, you might become rich. I mean, Jesus was the poster child for the generosity of God. He literally became poor so that you and I can be delivered from demon powers and our sin could be washed away and his spirit, his resurrection spirit could fill us and we would never walk alone and we would never walk without hope and he would be with us day and night, loving us, fulfilling our lives, working through us. How did he do that? He did it by himself giving everything away. He became poor. That's when he died at the cross. The Christian religion, the only religion that has the complete, utter poverty of its God at the heart. He became poor so that we might become rich. I know of nothing like this because of his great love for us. And two verses later it says, so you excel in all these other things. Excel in the grace of giving. Maybe God would say to us as we come to this Christmas season, even though giving is an obligation for all of us, why not excel at the grace of giving? Not just tolerate the obligation of giving, but just let God, because this is the Jesus heart. He became poor that others may be rich. And this is why we're generous. David Bentley Hart, in his book, Atheist Delusions, he writes this, even the most ardent secularists among us generally cling to notions of human rights, economic and social justice, providence for the indigent. We all hold to legal equality and basic human dignity. But it is simply the case that we, the distant children of the pagans, would not be able to believe in any of these things. They would, in fact, have never occurred to us had our ancestors not once believed that God is love, that charity is the foundation of all virtues, that all of us are equal before the eyes of God, and that to fail to feed the hungry or care for the suffering is to sin against Christ, and that Christ laid down his life for the least of his brethren. Why are we generous? I mean, it wouldn't dawn on us. I was talking to somebody this week who works cross-culturally and lives in a very different part of the world from us, in a world that has no Judeo-Christian ethic in the religious system of that nation at all. Very religious, but no Judeo-Christian ethic. And he was talking to me about how they're trying to care for orphans, but it's lost on most people in authority in their culture of even caring for little children. They're just branded. If they're orphans, they're just garbage. I mean, why would you want to do anything out of the ordinary? In fact, they're trying to shut down our orphanage. And I said, well, don't they care about the kids? And they said, that's not in their culture. That's totally lost on them. I want to tell you, atheists, I saw a bumper sticker here in Springfield, atheists don't need God to love others. You know, and I know atheists can make that argument, but the fact is, in most of the world, you need God. You need something that defines human dignity to love, and especially to sacrifice for others. And it all comes down to where it's all centered. The God who created us has loved us so much that he sent his own son, and Jesus became poor for our sakes, that we, that our world, that the unreached nations of the world can be made rich through him. This is the heartbeat of God. This is the heartbeat for your neighbors. This is the heartbeat of God for your family members, for everybody you'll give Christmas gifts to and for everybody you won't give Christmas gifts to. This is the heartbeat of God. He became poor so he could pour out his riches on people around us. And that's why we even have the instinct to be generous, let alone the pull of God's spirit in our heart to be generous, to give away. This is it. And so in verse 7 of the next chapter in 2 Corinthians, where he's still tying all this back because they're not following through on 1 Corinthians 16, he just says each one of you should give what you've decided in your heart to give. Don't give reluctantly or under compulsion. For God loves a cheerful giver. How can you ever be happy about letting things go and giving them away? How can you ever be happy? It's God's heart. This is a supernatural enterprise. This is a work of God's Spirit. And he said, and God is able to bless you abundantly so that in all things, at all times, having all that you need, you will abound in every good work. This is it. Having all things you need, you're going to abound. This is why some Christians falsely teach although it's only a half, it is a truth, but it's only a half truth. And they'll turn it into something selfish. Rather than keeping the focus on the people God has a heart for, they will say, if I give, God will give me back. And that's half true. That is true. Paul says it right there. God knows when you start going this way generously, God knows how to start abounding back to you in many ways. I don't know how this works. I don't know how God makes this happen. I remember as being a college student, sitting in a church in my little church by the University of Minnesota of 75 people, and a missionary speaks and the pastor gets up and says, we're going to take an offering from the missionary. I had $8 to my name, and those $8 were in my wallet. I was a poor student, and I heard the words inside of me deep, give your last $8 to this missionary. And I said to myself, I rebuke that thought. No way. I only got $8. I need stuff this week. I remember how I had the fight with God. Then I looked around, 75 people. I said, God, this offering, there's enough people here that this offering, plus or minus $8, the missionary is not going to notice it. And I went global. And I said, God, your global enterprise to take the gospel to the unreached parts of the world, it will not exactly rise or fall on my $8. I said to the Lord, I need that $8 more than you need it. And God, he's so patient, didn't even yell at me, just that quiet voice, put your last $8 in the offering. And I don't know how God put my last $8 in that offering. And I don't know how God met my needs the next week and the week after. But something unleashed in my heart that Sunday evening sitting in that service where God says, are you going to let me start prying your fingers open so that you can start living in my abundance and not your greediness and what you can manufacture for yourself? Because security in life is a myth. And hoarding will need to be justified before God when we stand before Jesus in light of all the people he has such a heart for. But what a gracious thing. He began to give me the joy of giving. And I walked out of that service just kind of happy that I obeyed the Lord. It's a good feeling to live freely with open hands. And he just, ever since, the more I give, the more he just keeps giving back. And so I just try to keep giving more. And this is a whole different dimension of living our lives. And this is what Paul is inviting them to. He said, I know you don't feel like you can afford this offering, but you know, the Lord's people in Jerusalem, what a heart God has for them. And you know, if even though you're putting this offering off, even though you don't think you can afford it, if you will give to the Lord and to his people, God's got his way. God's got his way of coming back. So let's go as we close to the very last, back to 1 Corinthians 16. Because then just a few verses later, after talking about this offering, he's going to sum up the entire book in four powerful words. There's only four words to verse 14, and they will keep us busy the rest of our lives. And this is Paul's parting exhortation to the church. Do everything in love. Do everything in love. So we're going to set ourselves at the beginning of this Christmas season to do everything in love. That means we're not going to give just out of obligation. We're going to ask God for his love for the people around us so that we can then do everything in love. To a church that was divided over celebrity preachers, remember that in the first three chapters? And they were divided over their favorite doctrines other than the cross of Christ. He said, just do everything in love. To a church that was tolerating sexual sin and where members were taking each other to court, he just said, would you just do everything in love? To a church where issues of marriage and singleness were confusing mature believers and spiritual abuse was taking place towards young believers in the name of personal rights, he just said, would you just do everything in love? To a church where there were haves and have-nots during the communion services when they came to the Lord's table. To a church where spiritual gifts were being misused in worship to put the spotlight on themselves rather than the needs of other people. And to a church that really did not want to let go of their money, Paul says, would you just do everything in love? And it strikes me that verse 14 of 1 Corinthians 16, just at the end of this letter, if they had done that, there would have been none of these problems in the Corinthian church. If they just would have done everything in love. It catches the whole heart of God. The most famous verse in the Bible is John 3:16. I really felt it just to close with this verse. It doesn't say, for God so loved the world that he kept what was most precious to him and just let us flail around in hopelessness. No. So this is what God did for us. God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life. The God who gave. The God who did everything in love. He so loved the world. And the God who says to you and me, with our co-workers, with our families, with our gift-giving this season, with our sacrificing financially to take the message of Jesus around the world, he'd say, would you do, just do everything in love. Just do it in love. Not because of you, for you to get ahead, not give to get. Would you just do everything in love? And watch the dimension that you can start to walk in. So I'd like to invite you to stand with me.